Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about parades from 1999 from Herald Square here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Couric.
Oh, God. You made me Matt Lauer in this equation?
Took me a second to realize I was going to have to take Couric.
I guess,
you can always take Roker.
I simply refuse.
You can always take Roker.
Yeah, okay. I'll be right.
All right, Matt, let's go.
I'm Christina Aguilera, and I am performing my song "What a Girl Wants." No, I'm all three. I'm all three members of Shit Daisy. I'm Lou Bega and the new Captain Kangaroo.
I am star of film and television, Kevin Bacon.
Oh my God! This okay? So
I'm the cast of Freaks and Geeks.
Who, by the way, cast. Kevin Bacon shows up exclusively to promote the Bacon Brothers band.
It's incredible. Just to get a little bit of context.
It was great. This is the best movie we've done all year. So
I want to say, I get a text message from Emily that says, have you and Kenny covered the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade? A question that, I mean, had an obvious answer, but I said, no, we've not. And then I suggested that we do a mini episode on this because we love Emily and we know she loves parades and her
whatever
parade
she
podcast
wants.
Needs help getting off the ground.
Parade pod coming parade soon.
Parodcast. You're welcome.
So here we are. We are talking about the 73rd annual Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. It was held on November 25th, 1999 in New York City, shown to viewers on NBC the same day at 9 a.m. to 12 noon Eastern. It was hosted by Katie Couric, Matt Lauer, and Al Roker. We'll talk about the participants. There are many. The poster, just to describe the poster for you guys, has Blue playing the biggest game of Blue's Clues. Snoopy celebrates the new millennium, and the soon-to-be-named Honey Nut Cheerios bee flies with a honeypot on the poster for the 1999 parade.
Blue was all
there
over.
There is a Wikipedia, a wiki for this specific show. I'm not going to go through all of this because we'll talk about this, but there are a couple new floats worth highlighting here. There's an Ask Jeeves float. There's a medieval Dragon Tales.
I definitely watched this in real life.
Golden Dollar Stagecoach.
In the moment.
The Millennium Time Continuum. Well, I don't even know what that even means. Austin Powers and Blue's Clues. So those are the new floats for this particular.
They should have done a Y2K float. Just had
really
it
really should have.
But I remember watching. I loved the parade. I mean, Emily, I was tickled when you suggested we should do this.
Yeah,
I tried as I texted with both of you. I try to watch it every year. I fail inevitably, but I do wake up. I put it on. I hope people will come and join me. It's usually just my dad, and we watch the parade together as long as we can.
It's adorable.
Lexi, my sister, will watch the parade too. And it's always been a thing in my family, not like a thing where like we actually did it, a thing where we like talked about doing it and I would be there alone. Sure. So when there's a parade float, like Ask Jeeves, when there's a corporate mascot, I always remember there's something fourth wall breaking, mm-hmm, about a corporate mascot getting a parade float or a balloon. Like the Honey Nut Cheerios bee does this year.
So I have to ask the question here. You're both American. I'm Canadian. So
we're recording this in October. So Phil feels comfortable.
I do. It's true. We are currently in the Canadian Thanksgiving seasons, and I appreciate that we're talking about it then. This is obviously a big deal. Even in Canada, for all intents and purposes, people do watch it in Canada. I don't mean to qualify it by saying even in Canada, but why did this become what it became in terms of like an American staple? How did this happen? Do you guys know?
It's always been a staple as long as I've been alive. I have not actually thought to research this, which is what makes this such a lousy backdoor pilot for Parodcast. The thing about it is, unlike the Rose Bowl parade, which is the other big one, like it is unabashedly capitalist. It is unabashedly commercial. It is unabashedly, we're ushering in the Christmas season. And like, I do
know exactly what it is.
Yeah, I do know that the roots of this are Macy's was like, we want to get everyone to celebrate the Christmas shopping season, which traditionally starts the day after Thanksgiving. So we're going to throw a parade on Thanksgiving Day and Santa Claus is going to end the parade. Mm-hmm. And then people are going to be ready to go shop. And gradually it's become a celebration of everything you can buy in America. I, after I finished watching this, went and watched the 2001 Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, just the start of it, because 2001, wild year for America, some stuff happened. It starts with this very somber Star Spangled Banner. And then as Katie Kirk and Matt Lauer looking at you very seriously, and they're like, of course, it's been a hard year for all of us since the events of September 11th, but America never gives up. And that's why we're having a Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. I'm glad we kept it alive.
I love everything about what you just said. You just nailed it in every way. Okay. One thing I want to, it's not, I'm not quibbling. I'm not trying to contradict Phil, but the thing about American traditions to me versus traditions in other countries, at least as far as I can tell, is they're really never as fervent here as they are in other countries. So like, is the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade a thing? Yeah, it's a thing. Is it a tradition? Yeah, it's a tradition. But like, 95% of people don't care. You know, a few, like a person like me.
Yeah.
It hits all of my sensory pleasure zones. I love Broadway. I love New York City. I love the fall. I love shopping. I love Christmas. I love stupid fucking characters. I love weird celebrities. I like, this is like, it just, it works. It works for me so well. And in particular, like, I guess I didn't realize this. We've done every movie, every TV show, every commercial of this year, every music video, everything. This is by far the most dated thing we've done. And it's not,
I didn't
just
even know that Shadazy was a thing.
It's not just because of the Shadazy and the Wild Orchid and the Lou Big and all the things that are obviously dated, but the things like, what, Emily, what's the 700 person choir group, America Sings.
Oh yeah, America Sings. Oh,
with an exclamation point.
Yeah,
that
which I auditioned for.
There you go. That America Sings was on its last legs, like in the 80s, I think. But like, it stuck around for things like the parade, and there were these kind of things, marching bands, things like that, sure, that only got their due at the Macy's Day Parade. And it's funny because I always called it the Macy's Day Parade. Is that not what it's called? It's the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. And the other thing about Macy's for me and my stupid family is, one, my mom worked at Macy's on 34th Street, that she was like a shop girl, and that's where she met my dad. So Macy's means something to my family.
That's nice.
And then Miracle on 34th Street was always the kind of movie in my family, because, you know, we're cheesy enough to call them meeting there our Miracle on 34th Street. Mm-hmm. And Macy's always meant something. Macy's is like a thing. So like, even more than, you know, where I'm on some like fucking, you know, Don Draper and the Hershey's bar shit with Macy's.
So, okay, I have some questions about.
I'm similar. I just want to say I have just exactly the same vibe as you, Kenny, including that your parents are my parents and they met at Macy's.
And they also met at Macy's. So am I crazy? Everyone's lip syncing, right? Like, no one is actually singing.
When Lou Bega sings, he forgets to lip sync several things and then he smiles at the camera.
I mean, everyone, not just is everybody lip syncing, and it looks obvious that they're lip syncing. No one gets to finish their songs. Everyone's cut off, it seems, like halfway through a song. I just don't really understand.
That's how it should be.
The production makes me happy, and also I just don't really understand.
Well, you're working with like the D team. These are people who are down to work on Thanksgiving. You know, you're not working with A-plus players here.
It's great. I also think that whoever, you know, we did an episode last week on Get Bruce. Whoever's writing the script for the jokes and for the layups to the various performances is not up to the task.
It was Bruce.
It might have been Bruce Flint.
I love that every time there's a balloon, someone has written just a list of things about how big the balloon is.
Oh, I do.
Katie
too.
Couric
I do
and Matt too. Lauer have it. To read credulously. They're like, "And this inflatable Barney is bigger than any T-Rex." And I'm like, I mean, sure.
This is what I love. You are hitting it. This is what I love. I love this inane.
I know you do too.
I'm not trying to. I'm yelling out of passion and excitement.
I am too. In the post-revolution world, when we live in the workers' paradise and we're sitting around on a Thanksgiving day when everyone can share equally and everyone is cared for, I'm still going to be like, I kind of miss the Macy's parade. I'm just going to be like, I miss when everything was about how many like snack cakes you could buy. There's I have this tiny little piece of me that loves everything shitty about America, and this is where I put all of it. The Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade.
I love it. Yeah. It's my piece is not that tiny. my whole body was that until fairly recently terms of my life, right? Mm-hmm. Until fairly recently, like I was very much like the ultimate capitalist consumer. And didn't see necessarily a contradiction between my like my social politics and my love of like all things bright and tasty and colorful. So it's more than a little part of me, but yeah, something like, you know, it feels a little bit like maybe in the workers' paradise, this could be. Take Severance. Did you watch you watch Severance? I would imagine. Sure. This feels a little bit like a pancake party to me. Like, we deserve this, or waffle party. We deserve this every once in a while, right?
I love that. I do want to give just a couple shout outs to some balloons and floats, if that's okay, because they've been around for a long time, guys.
Did they deserve it? My name? I'm Emily St. James.
Don't worry. They
Big Bird, this is his 12th time doing this in 99.
Yeah.
Good for him. Also, Quick Bunny.
I would have taken the over on Big Bird.
Really? Yeah. That
12?
Yeah, 12 seems low. Yeah.
Quick Bunny's an interesting one because he's one of those guys who is a corporate mascot, but has become so ingrained, such a part of the fabric where you don't see him that way anymore. Like the Energizer Bunny, like the Coke polar bears, just let him in. These guys are good. These guys are good.
This is Garfield's 14th time. He's beaten Big Bird, which I'm kind of surprised about.
Boo.
Garfield's the worst.
Novelty balloons. The white Macy's stars, 14th time. The ice cream cone, 13th time. I mean, again, these are, less impressive.
Do better.
Some of the floats, soaring spirit canoe, 14th time. Kenny is loving this. I don't know what the soaring spirit canoe even is, but sure. The Big Apple, 17th time.
Gotta have the Big Apple.
The Big Apple.
You might think you were in the wrong city if it weren't for the Big Apple.
And then Santa Land Express and Coal Car, 15th time from Oshkosh Bagosh. I mean, there's some specialty units worth shouting out. The New York Police Department, 15th time. The Holiday Treat for Children Everywhere banner, 19th time. My favorite is that the New York City Police Department Mounted Patrol, 73rd time, guys.
That never goes out of style, police on horses.
Apparently not.
People are always going to get excited to see police on horses.
Yeah.
We have some special guests. Obviously, I'm not going to run through all of them. There were a lot of them. We have the cast of Freaks and Geeks.
Did you watch it?
Yes, I did.
It was so awkward.
It was so awkward and awful. I hated it. Cool and the Gang sang Celebration. Obviously, I guess they just have to. The cast members of Third Watch showed up. Everyone's favorite Rudy Giuliani showed up and talked a little bit about...
He's not my favorite Rudy Giuliani. There are three or four Rudy Giulianis I like more than him.
Yeah. I fucking loved the one time they let George Lazenby do it. He was so good as Rudy Giuliani. Impressive.
He was really good. I mean, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. There's just a lot of very interesting acts that showed up to do this. Now, if I'm being honest, the real reason that Emily, I wanted to have you on, not just to talk parades, we're very excited to hear your top 10 list of 1999 as we wrap up our 99 podcast. As Kenny mentioned, you've been on this podcast.
I mentioned this on the other podcast. So, oh, yeah. I believe this is your 14th. And
this
your 15th
will be the 15th.
Your 15th will be the last of the.
I'm going to read out what you've been on for, Emily, just so it's worth noting. Blair Witch Project, Story of Us, Bicentennial Man, The Matrix, Freaks and Geeks, Mickey's Once Upon a Christmas and A Christmas Carol. You came up for a Felicity episode. The Iron Giant. West Wing pilot, you came on with our favorite Alan Sepinwall, and you did a Matrix
second favorite
episode. Yeah. And now let's hear your top 10.
I realize I'm the one who imposed a limit on when this had to stop, but I'm not done talking about this fucking parade.
Okay. You were the one that put a limit.
Yes,
on
you
this.
Were. That's true.
I'll just, look at this. I'm going to text my friend and say I'm running a little late. Perfect. Something came up.
That's fantastic.
No, I one of the things that I've realized as this podcast is sort of winding its way to its close, and I do still in my sleep deprived state want to do that thing I pitched to you before we recorded the, I think that would be fun. I think that this is a podcast about obviously nostalgia, but it is and watching this Thanksgiving Day parade for me really crystallized that this is a specific form of nostalgia people our age have. People probably who were between the ages of, let's say, 10 and 25 when this specific Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade aired. When you look at like boomer nostalgia, it tends to be, boy, when we were kids, things were pretty fucking crazy, but then we fixed the world. Yep. And Gen X nostalgia tends to be, boy, when we were kids, there were some great fucking movies, and then the world was pretty okay. And millennial and younger nostalgia is like, oh my God, there was this era when things were okay and the world was basically fine. And ever since then, it's been just like falling apart. And yet there are these vestiges of that world that are left, and we are still living in it because there's this continual presentation of entertainment from our youths. And this is this constant that always exists. We're coming up on the 100th year of it in 2026. And it's, I don't even know how to qualify. Watching this made me realize how much I don't miss that age in my life. Cause I, you know, my family was not great and I had all these other things. I do miss feeling the way I felt in 1999. And this is a podcast about attempting to capture the way you felt at a time in a way that feels, you know, driven by a sense that we have lost something and we don't know what it is, more than just the thing that you always get when you grow up and you become more cognizant of the ways that the world sucks. But like, yeah. So when I saw Lou Bega and the second Captain Kangaroo doing Mambo Number 5,
shed a
tear. I remembered what it was like to be young and what it was like to feel like the world was okay.
Oh, God. I at least for me, and this is far less eloquent or interesting than what you just said, but I didn't know when I would be able to watch this because, you know, too many kids, too little time. And I figured I can probably sneak it while putting my son to bed and laying in the he's in his crib and I'm laying on a bed next to him. And I'll just put it on my iPhone with headphones. And what that meant was I couldn't use my phone while I was on this, which is a pretty big deal. What I've lost, at least, is the ability to focus on one thing at a time.
Sure.
And being forced to watch this ridiculous parade and being forced to like go into this 99 rabbit hole was so like refreshing. I felt like Jake Sully as he's going into the body of the Avatar. Sure. It's just like, finally, like I'm somewhere that I can, that I recognize, because I really am like truly a little bit like in life, a little bit lost because of my phone. My phone is like taking over my life in a way that I really despise and I'm working on fixing. And the only thing that seems to like to steal my attention is when I watch things on my phone or when I watch the Bar Rescue Channel on Pluto TV. So that's the list.
Wow. That is super specific.
Put on some Bar Rescue and I can maybe focus on it, but that's it.
Okay.
I love John Taffer. What can I say?
Yeah, I get it. So Emily, yes. Do you have a top 10 that you'd like to walk through with us?
Well, listen, I'm compiling it as we speak. I
could vamp for a little longer.
I'm remembering my top 10 from when I was alive at this time. And it's so different from what my top 10 is now. Sure. You know, at the time it was very much like, oh, I fucking loved American Beauty. You know, I loved, I feel like Three Kings probably holds up, but I just, as a trans woman, I cannot support David O. Russell at this point in time. So I'm not letting him be on my top 10, which I have now finished.
All right,
so listen to me vamp. My number one now was my number one then. It has not changed. It's Being John Malkovich, which so I
you're
think
starting is, at one and working your way down.
Yes, I'm working my way down. I think it is a brilliant movie about identity, about what it means to be the person you are and what it would mean to be somebody else. And I love Charlie Kaufman, and I still kind of think that's low key his best script. I don't know. Yep. Number two is The Matrix. Obvious reasons. Big, great movie.
Two-part episode.
Incredibly thoughtful, incredibly good. There's never been anything like it. Toy Story 2, number three. Nice. It was my number three at that time, too, as I recall. I just really love that movie. I think it is one of Pixar's best. It just operates like a machine. And another problematic director, but you know what? I don't care. Toy Story 2 overcomes all. Eyes Wide Shut, number four. Nice. Brilliant little look at, you know, married life. My number five, I don't know if you've covered this one. It's Corrieta's Afterlife. Did you touch on that one?
We haven't touched on that one.
That's one of my favorite movies about death. I'll say that. Number six is Magnolia, which I think is a pretty brilliant picture. I've had gone up and down with that movie over the years, and now I've kind of settled on, yeah, it's one of my favorite PTAs, even if it's like way too much at all times. Seven, Blair Witch Project. Just that movie just holds the fuck up for me. Awesome. Eight is Election. Tracy Flick is what I'm going for at all times. Nine is The Straight Story. Even, you know, muted Lynch is such an interesting, weird guy. And my number 10 is the documentary American Movie, which is a movie I've watched a billion times and adore. And I like to put at my number 10 spot some movie I just like want to shout out for whatever reason. And it definitely, it's got to be American Movie.
I can't wait for us to cover American
Movie. We can't knock any of those, except for Afterlife. I mean, come on. But we can't knock any of the other ones.
Bunch
of great films. Yeah.
They're all great films. I think that you do channel Tracy Flick. You're my Tracy Flick.
Does it mean you're going to try to destroy me?
No. But more than anything, I mean, obviously, you've been on this podcast a whole bunch, and we love you, and we love your mind and the way that you think about movies and music and TV and all that stuff. And it's been just such a gift having you on all these years.
I'm so glad to have been able to be on. I'm so glad that people can chart my journey into being a full human being by hearing me talk about movies from 1999.
They really can, by the way.
And you know what?
Quite a document.
You know what? I was at a party recently where people were talking about podcasts like it's 1999, and they were like, "Oh, it's too bad that it's, you know, coming to an end or whatever."
Stop it.
Seriously.
No, that's so sweet.
The person who told me this, his name is Todd, which you're going to find very amusing if you've listened to my life across this podcast.
Sure. So help me, Todd.
Yeah.
And Skylar Austin.
And I pitched him my idea for what should be the penultimate episode that I will host. And he thought it was brilliant. And you know what? If it doesn't happen now, people are going to be like, what the fuck was it?
Wait, is this what you pitched Phil before I came on?
But please. No, I've pitched the two of you on this before we did Funny People back in the day.
Oh, what is it?
So
remind us.
No, because I don't want the people to know. When we hang up, I will remind you. I'll tell you off mic.
Well, listen.
Let's hang up. I give the parade a 91. It wasn't my best parade yet.
I'm
kidding.
I'm giving this parade a 101, as all parades deserve.
I give this parade I give it a 92. I mean, as far as parades go, I don't really have much to compare it to.
If you enjoyed this backdoor pilot for Parodcast, tweet at the.
You say like, Parodcast.
Tweet at President Joe Biden that you want more Parodcast.
I mean, there are so many parades though.
Go to moveon.org.
That's the thing. You know what is like? We're going to branch out. We're going to do like old Soviet era parades. It's going to be great. It's going
to
be
documents to wonderful. Watch of all these parades.
Listen, now? you got to go to some shady places on YouTube, but you can watch parades. I sent you all. I think parades. It's like Pong Gods 1987.
Yeah. Pong God. Yeah, the parade man.
Well, this was a pleasure as always. We can't wait to hear your pitch for the penultimate episode off mic, and hopefully we'll do it. It'll be great.
And I just want to say to the listeners, anytime you want to watch a Macy's parade, just watch the first 5 minutes, hear all the people that are on it. You will know everything you need to know about that year. I just watched the first 5 minutes of 1983 last night, and there's someone named Tara, the tap dancing elephant. And I want to know what
that's about. Here's the other thing. The announcer is the SNL announcer, correct?
Don Pardo. Yeah.
Okay. Amazing.
Yeah, that part he does a good job with all the silly names.
A blast as always.
She Daisy.
So now that we're done, let's hear your penultimate pitch.
I want to do the pardon the interruption where I just pick up like 10 to 15 1999 topics.
Oh, I would love to do that. Yes. Here's the thing, and we can talk about this.
I don't
this
know as, what Kenny's about to
we
say.
We can probably talk about this as a family. I very much want to do the part of the eruption. That's a great idea. I pitched Phil on how to do Magnolia, which I can't decide if it should be our last episode or second to last episode. And I also, we need to do our wrap up of the podcast, which I'm fine with not being the last episode too, because what I have planned for Magnolia, I think, is going to feel like the end of Magnolia. So
I can't wait. This, by the way, Emily, is entirely on Kenny. He's just decided to take this upon himself, and I really don't know what this
is. I want to give Phil a parting gift. Yeah.
We should absolutely do pardon the interruption, though. That'd be a blast. Why not? Yeah, let's do it.
Throw so you in. You will not tell us the topics beforehand.
Which I will send you a list of like.
No, I don't want them. I don't want the topics. Cool. I don't want the topics. I would love a board though. If you could make a board, that'd be amazing.
Okay.
it could even be a share screen situation, a board, if you could figure out how to I don't want the part under the eruption board where you know everything that's coming, or maybe we do. Maybe it'll be fun just to see, like, if you just said Shadaisy and we don't know what you're going to ask or what you're going to talk about.
I think that is amazing. And also an opportunity to be able to cover some stuff that we like, Afterlife, for instance, like stuff that we haven't, you know what I mean?
Stuff that like we've heard of.
I think it's not going to be. I think
Afterlife
it's not
was
gonna
not
be
a movie that was even on our radar. Like, I didn't even know that was a movie.
I think it's I mean, that's because I went and looked at David Sims's list and I was like, right, I fucking love Afterlife.
What does he have? He has Rosetta High, right?
No, Rosetta at number one, I think. Or it's like
Number 11.
Eyes Wide Shut is number one. But he has Rosetta High and he's Bojoval High.
I mean, Daniel Waters, I sent you Daniel, because Daniel Waters is coming on.
Daniel Waters had like three French films I hadn't heard about. Yeah, I know. It's like everyone's list. It's all like the movies that, you know, there's like a batch of 25 appropriate movies to put on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he threw like three random ass foreign films I'd never. French.
You know who we're also getting Sarah Pauly when she comes on. She's going to get her top 10 list. So
everyone coming Sarah on Pauly? Phil got Sarah Pauly.
Wow. Canada pride.
Damn right.
Going out with a bang. What if you just like had me come on and do Pardon in your Interruption with Sarah Pauly? She'd love that.
With Sarah Pauly would actually be incredible.
I think she would like it. Everything I know about her, I think she would enjoy
it. She is the loveliest. All right.
In fairness, like, she's mostly coming on to promote women talking to our audience. So let's just get real. Totally kidding. She
is. To our audience of 1,000 people.
Listen, we should plan this out by email. I gotta walk to lunch.
Yes. All right. We'll talk about it on text.
All right. See y'all later.
Bye. Bye.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a closet full of t-shirts here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nyborg.
And I'm Phil Iskov.
And with us again is our own personal Bruce Valanche, Joe Reed. Just cracking jokes over here.
I'm in the center left square on the Hollywood Square.
Yes, that's right.
I've fallen down a little bit of a YouTube rabbit hole with episodes of the Whoopi Goldberg era Hollywood Squares lately. That YouTube at some point just decided that they thought I would like. They just started suggesting them to me, and they were correct.
Yeah, I was going to say, sounds like they know Joe.
Can I just say though, the YouTube might actually be the best what's the fucking word I'm looking for?
Streaming service? Yeah.
No, not streaming service. The algorithm. They fucking know.
They know you better than you know yourself.
They really do.
They know you. They certainly know my son. You wouldn't believe how many truck videos they watch. Joe.
Yes.
Oh, go ahead. I was just gonna say
that we are we're talking Get Bruce today. We're talking everyone's favorite 79-minute documentary. I don't know that this. I mean, this apparently got a theatrical release, which is bonkers to me.
It definitely got a theatrical release.
I mean, that's.
I remember this movie very much.
You remember this movie much better than I do, Kenny.
I don't know why. Because there's something about this that is in my particular wheelhouse, my like exact sweet spot. It was reviewed on Siskel and Ebert, which is where you start for me. It's about the Oscars. It's just like, it's this documentary that came out like it after documentaries were kind of allowed to be like frothy and nothing-ish.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like there was this moment in the late, I mean, you know, it's not a fair thing to hang on it because his documentaries are not this at all, but Michael Moore kind of opened up the doors to different kinds of documentaries. You know, certainly like his were always, he's always had an element of humor and an element of like, like kind of, you know, subverting the medium a little bit in a way that we hadn't really seen before that. And then, you know, you wound up with movies like Get Bruce, which is like a dumb nothing of a movie.
But yeah, it's not a great documentary. Like well, if we're going to be by documentary standards,
it's just a dumb nothing of a movie. Yeah. It's insane that someone put money behind this.
It's really, this is the type of thing that if this was made today, it would definitely be, if it was made today, I'm putting a big if there, this would be a streaming thing for sure. This would be like, this would be something that would like scream it. It would screen at a Sundance. It would get picked up at like an HBO Films thing or a Showtime or whatever. It would, you know, and that would be that.
I don't know. This guy, I don't know. Like, look, I am a person, and I'll admit this willingly.
I'll give you that
I'm a human. I am a human.
Yes.
Who will watch any Fred Lebowitz content? Any Fred Lebowitz content. So it's not that I'm above.
YouTube figured that out about me too at one point. Where they were just like all the Fran Lebowitz.
Yeah, any Fran you got, I'll watch. Yeah. So it's not as if like, you know, like pretend it were a city. I watch the whole fucking thing.
It's great.
Yeah. So it's not as if I'm above watching like kind of this like ephemeral, you know, nonsense.
Sure.
This ephemeral like celebrity adjacent nonsense. But Bruce is like there's nothing to this guy. This is our lamest celebrity.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Joe disagrees.
Well, no, I don't necessarily. I'm not going to call Bruce lame because, you know, but he was never meant to be famous in his own right. Right. Like he is built to be the behind the scenes guy writing the one-liners. Right. And so it's sort of this like accident of the moment that he, and it was Hollywood Squares, really, like that's the first time anybody really ever saw him, was he was writing for Whoopi. Whoopi was the center square. She was producing that show. And she was just like, well, just be on screen. You're the one who's writing up all these one-liners.
How long did that run for?
That's a very good question.
I remember it, but
I feel like I was a little harsh towards Bruce. Let me pull back a little bit on my harshness.
Okay.
And just say, it's not that I don't respect the hustle, you know. I do respect the hustle, and I do respect that there is, you know, that in the 90s in particular, there was a need for this guy or what he does.
Yeah.
But I also think what he does is like such a relic of a time I don't want to return to ever. It's a type of humor and a type of celebrity that makes me fucking like cringe. It's not him. I find him to be kind of charming.
Yes.
It's the people that would hire him. It's this idea of like, it's gross. It's this idea of like, give me your best Monica Lewinsky joke.
Yeah.
That kind of like makes me kind of, you know, ugly. And it's like I said to Phil, everybody in this movie, with one exception, I think, became comedically irrelevant days after this landed in the theaters.
Maybe before.
The only person I feel like who was like, who was prominently featured, who I don't think became comedically irrelevant immediately, was, and not because of this movie, they just kind of, they were all like, you know, 80s people who were just kind of treading water into the 90s, is Lily Tomlin. But outside of that, like, they all kind of like, you know, they were of a different time.
Yeah. Well, it's, yeah, go ahead, Sarita.
Well, I was going to say, Hollywood Squares ran from 1998 to 2004.
Okay, that's a good run.
It also, though, he's emblematic of, Kenny, what you said about sort of like that era of comedy, but also this, it reminded me of, not in quality, the Joan Rivers A Piece of Work documentary, which is that a much better documentary. Rules.
Yeah.
It's really good. But it also is a portrait of somebody who worked in comedy her entire life, who worked in kind of like the salt mines of comedy, right? Where just like the work of it. So much of that movie is about the hard work, tooth and nail, kind of, you know, card catalog full of jokes kind of a thing. And just the way that she had to work at it and to sort of, and you look at Joan Rivers comedy and there's great stuff and there's stuff that, there's 8 billion cringe Monica Lewinsky jokes, and you know what I mean, in the Joan Rivers repertoire. And but it's this thing of, you think of comedy as this, you know, genius takes the stage and grabs a mic and slays a crowd and all this sort of stuff. And I love seeing this, the other side of it, where it's just sort of like the unglamorous, you know, not that cute side of just like, you know, clawing out a career.
I also want to say one other thing.
Yeah.
I like these 79 minutes. Oh, like these are my kind of minutes. Like I, so it's funny you bring up Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, also comedian with Jerry Seinfeld. Those were in a sense, those were two really interesting documentaries that shone a light on, you know, you always hear, and we've all seen Lenny, and you always hear, you know, the most miserable people in the world are comedians, but really just the hard work of it. But I loved. This felt to me like, and it's not the movie, which it's kind of this global thing I take away from it, is, I don't know, some of these guys don't feel like they're working that hard. They're like kind of they're kind of giving it all to Bruce.
Yeah.
Bruce is doing the work, which he seems to do very easily. Yeah. And like it almost just like he just kind of wakes up and spits out these B-minus jokes. And all right, go ahead. Your C plus, D minus. I don't know, Phil. Like you're not gonna
offend me if you think the jokes are worse than I do.
I don't love the jokes.
This was a really cringy thing for me to watch, if I'm being completely honest, not just because like the stuff didn't date well, but also just because it gives all this like adoration to, if I'm being completely honest, a brand of comedy that we all fucking hate. No one likes what the presenters say at fucking award shows. If they could just come out and just say who won, we'd all be much fucking happier. So like, why are we sitting
here? Great point. That's like, that is true. That is the ad. You're right, Phil.
It's also one of those things.
He's been made fun of so much for this, though. It's like people definitely get it, but yeah.
Yes. But that's also a thing where, like, when it's done well, in the occasions that it is done well, it's memorable for doing that. I don't think I would credit the done well ones to Bruce Vilanch, but also, but you go back and you watch those Whoopi Goldberg Oscars, and like her stuff, I think holds up better than a lot of old Oscar hosts. I've watched a lot of old
Oscar stuff. Her hosting gigs were great. I totally agree.
Crystal stuff.
I agree 100%.
Yeah.
I would also say that the Billy portion of this was maybe the most cringy of all of them.
Yeah.
For me,
well,
watching them
do
fucking bits with bagels and fruit. And I was just like, guys,
I know.
Get me the fuck.
I know.
Out of
comedy
here.
Was so broken. It was like so broken.
Like,
and that's why
Phil, he thinks it's comedy gold. He's like, with this gold. Thank you. Yeah. I hope you guys are rolling. It's like,
I mean, that so much of the 99 podcast, and I guess I was like kind of wrong when I said this, but I'll say it again. Like, there weren't great comedies in 99. There were like six. I said there was two.
You said two, I think, or one.
I think there was two. I think I said two or one. I think there were.
And then I think Jessica Ellis took you to task a little
bit. It was No, it wasn't Jessica Ellis. Wasn't it like Adam Bivari? But
I don't know.
Wasn't it on someone recently? Malkovich?
I think it was.
I thought it
was when she did her top 10 after Warzone, everyone's favorite 1990.
Yeah, that was 1990. Everyone's favorite 99.
Speaking of comedies,
but no, I mean, it's look, there are the good ones. There are Galaxy Quest, Office Space. As far as kind of big broad comedies, and then they're like the, you know, the more subversive ones, being John Malkovich and Election, and I think that's the list.
I mean, Office Space.
I said Office Space. Office Space and. And Galaxy Quest are kind of the ones that were trying to be funny, haha comedies and succeeded. Right. And then they're the ones that are trying to be kind of.
I mean, we still have
comedies.
Big Daddy to cover, and who knows?
Good flick.
Do you count the South Park movie among that?
Hilarious movie, one of the funniest movies ever made. Sure, it's a funny comedy, but also doing a different thing.
I'm sort of going through my list now. Bowfinger was that year.
Bowfinger, I love. Kenny
movie
doesn't
sucks.
Like Bowfinger.
Movie sucks.
That movie but, does suck.
But, you know what I like? I'm going to stick up for it, and then I'll let it go. But I'm a Cheerleader is 99, right?
Yes.
Well, we love
underrated
that.
Underrated movie. Great movie. Underrated.
But also a little subversive.
Subversive.
Oh, definitely. Oh, for sure.
I guess what I'm saying is I'm sure there were definitely great indie comedies, no question.
Yeah.
There, with the what I'm saying is throughout the 80s and 90s, and particularly the 80s, there were studio-approved comedies and studio-approved comedy directors that were churning out just hit comedies. And the only ones that kind of feel like that now, even Galaxy Quest is not really made by the, you know, by the old guard, right? Galaxy Quest is kind of made by some weirdos who got a shot. And Office Space is made by the guy who did Beavis and Butthead. Like, there really isn't that, like, vanguard in 99. And the guys who
this take is not very Shagadelic of you, Kenny, is what I was saying. Yeah.
We did talk about the Shagadelic movie. That's true. another movie that I think is very indicative of where we were in comedy at this time. Like, I think we ultimately decided, like, sure, it's fine. But, like, this is
There's so much Austin Powers that if I could just pick out the stuff that I love and leave everything else. Like, the stuff that I love about it is really funny.
The stuff that's, I mean, we did our episode on, which was, I mean, honestly, I think we did this in year one, Kenny, when we did.
Wow.
It was like our 16th episode.
It was early on. We both came into it being like, fuck this movie. And then by the end, we're like, wait a second, is this movie okay?
We kept cracking each other up with the you know, I'm going to do like, Phil, I'm going to just go all the way back. And now next time I give this ticket, I'll be like, all right, so it's actually 15 comedies.
It's actually 15. There's like also like, number one.
There's also Dick. There's just coming to me like every 2 seconds. There's also Superstar. There's also Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Yeah,
I mean, there are a lot of really, and then there's the teen comedies. So I'm wrong. It's a great year for comedy.
A pretty good year for comedy. But to your point though, which I think was your original point. The vanguards aren't there. There's a lot of good comedies, but these are coming from a whole bunch of weird sources.
The men who are responsible for the great 80s comedies
are gone.
Made duds this year.
Except for Bowfinger, which is great.
But Ron Howard made some great comedies, like and made Ed TV, which is a great movie, great comedy.
God damn it.
I got nothing.
He just keeps chopping himself off at the knees.
No, that was a bit.
but I do want to say on the Get Bruce side of things, you know, just in terms of a little bit of context for people, this basically is a documentary about Bruce Vilanch, who for 30 years were behind the scenes writing jokes, speeches, public material for actors, singers.
Still alive. I'm sure he's still doing it.
Maybe film examines Vilanch's meteoric rise to influence from his first meeting with Bette Midler in the early 70s to his latest collaborations on the Academy Awards. It's got a ton of celebrities that show up, but prominently Robin Williams, Billy Crystal, Whoopi Goldberg, Bette Midler. Those are the big ones. And they're the kind of organizing principle of the documentary.
And of course, Steven Seagal.
And
naturally, Steven Seagal.
So Get Bruce opened on September 17th, 1999 against Blue Streak. Another good comedy.
Great comedy. love that movie.
For Love of the Game, The Sixth Sense, Stigmata, and A Stir of Echoes. It would go on to
my take is terrible.
It's a bad take.
I love the comedies of
I know you do. This movie went on to make a whopping
what about American movie? All right, sorry, keep going.
Made $43,000. Roger Ebert gave the film 3 stars.
Made less than the script.
Roger.
Right. Roger says, Get Bruce is exactly the kind of documentary we all want made about ourselves, in which it is revealed that we are funny, smart, beloved, and trusted confidant to famous people. The power behind the scenes at great events and the apple of your mother's eye. That of all things are true of Bruce Vilanch only adds to it. I've known Bruce for 30 years. If there is a dark side to his nature, I believe it shows itself mostly when he can't decide what t-shirt to wear. The New York Times also
We've all been there.
Endearing, very funny, utterly unpretentious. Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with all of that. I think that this is not a good documentary in the sense that we don't really learn anything about Bruce Vilanch, whether we want to or not. We are not given said opportunity.
Right.
His mother, who's interviewed a fair amount, doesn't seem to even know that much about what's going on.
I would disagree. We do learn a decent amount about Bruce Vilanch. The two main things we learn. Uh-huh. One is we learn about the fact about his upbringing and
his parents. Yes.
Really, really unusual situation where everyone seemed to be adopted, but also exactly the same, which I really thought was great. Correct. The other thing that like a documentary made about Bruce Vilanch any year after 1999 would have made a far bigger deal about the fact that he is an out gay man.
Sure.
And, yeah, sure. And the part particularly, and this is always a big thing with Fran Lebowitz, about how many people he lost.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a big thing at the end of the movie, you know, at the end of the movie, he's constantly referring to the AIDS crisis as the plague, which I've heard it referred to many times within, you know, stuff that's in and around the LGBT community. And I think like that, I don't know the answer to this question. Would this have made a better movie or a worse movie or a more interesting movie or a less interesting movie? Was it enough? Was it not enough? Was it too much? Yeah. It's not inconsequential. And it's, I do wonder if it's the kind of thing where, you know, like, Bruce Vilanch, for those of you, look him up, like stop the podcast, look him up. If you don't know what he looks like, at one point he refers to himself, you know, as someone says he looks just like a Muppet. He does. He looks like one of the,
he looks
exactly like Sweetums. He looks like one of the large, like a human sized Muppet, and has this like wild kind of Broadway ready, like voice and personality. And that's why when you said he was meant to be behind the camera, Joe, I'm like, was he? But But so I don't know, Joe. I mean, you know, I don't think I'm breaking any new ground by saying maybe you should speak on this more than I should.
Sure.
But what do you think, Joe?
Well, I mean, I think gay men of an age that of, you know, Bruce Vilanch's age are always going to have my, you know, undying respect. And you know, it's you really have to give it up to that generation and it's really impossible to imagine the loss that those people went through and the fear and the danger and all that sort of stuff. And so anybody from that generation, I'm going to revere in some way, big or small, right? And so with somebody like Bruce Vilanch, who then took all of that, you know, anxiety and uncertainty and the pain of that era or whatever, to have built the kind of career that he made, which is, you know, light and funny. And obviously, like, it makes all the sense in the world that he, like, came up through the ranks, like, via Bette Midler, you know what I mean? And that whole kind of thing. Because there is just a sensibility that, like, he's that, like, classic old gay man sensibility, which is just, and he's obviously old now, that he was, you know, not an old guy back then. But
always an old soul, I think.
Yeah. Well, yes. Well, and I mean, the classic sort of like Liza adoring, you know, gay man or whatever, adoring Liza and also probably writing 8 billion Liza jokes throughout his, you know, life. She was always one of those, you know, how many Liza's wedding jokes did Whoopi Goldberg make in a single Oscar ceremony? Like a ton. But it's a sensibility that I find comforting in a way, even if I don't find it groundbreaking or particularly hilarious. There's a familiarity to it that I find very good. And it is these are jokes for the widest possible audiences, the mm-hmm. Oscars television audience, the, you know, a Clinton speech, you know what I mean? Anything like that. He's writing jokes for the broadest possible audience, but there's a knowingness to a lot of that that also speaks to his people, and his people are my people. And I will always have, you know, a place of appreciation for that. So
speaking to that, I do think that my brain kind of conflates Bruce Valanche and Harvey Fierstein.
Sure.
And I don't know if that's a fair thing to do. And I apologize if that's not.
They both played Edward Turnblad on Broadway. Right? So yeah.
Bruce played Edward Turnblad.
Bruce was one of the, I'm almost like,
was he good?
Lock me up if I'm wrong, but like, I didn't see it, but like there was a, after Harvey Fierstein left Hairspray, there was a succession of stunt casting for that role. And I'm almost certain Bruce Valanche was one of them because I think he showed up on the Rosie O'Donnell show, sans beard, because
I've seen him without the beard before.
Yeah. And I think George Wendt, who is not, as far as I know, gay, but like also was stepped into that role at one point.
He's very, very game though.
Oh yeah.
He's a very game man. George Wendt. He's always down to have fun.
Yeah,
I bet Bruce Valanche is okay. You know, it's not Harvey Fierstein.
The Harvey Fierstein.
Oh yeah, yeah. Go back to Harvey Fierstein.
Does
yeah.
feel like, because I just recently saw Bros.
Surprisingly,
I don't know, set off all sorts of Twitter feuds and what have you.
I really like it. I really liked it too.
I thought it was a very good movie.
Yeah.
I didn't see it because I'm straight.
When Harvey Fierstein shows up in that, I feel like that could have been Bruce Valanche. Like I feel like, do you know what I mean, in terms of the gay iconic, the iconography of them to some degree, yes, or another, they feel somewhat similar.
Harvey's got a little bit more of the gravitas in terms of, I think, like as a author of plays, sure, and this kind of stuff, but yeah, there's a Venn diagrams overlap that have
there's also a sense, I think, I wonder how much of this is kind of retrofitting, but there is also a sense of I think that they were kind of considered America's gay friend for a while. Of them, you know, like they were two men who were kind of allowed in the front door. Well, I'm not going to continue with this metaphor, but I know I do. I think that there was, I mean, some level of, okay, we're, you know, this is okay, and we will allow this to you know, make us laugh. But
the camp sensibility of a Bruce Valanche and a Harvey Fierstein in Independence Day are very similar. You know what I mean? Like it's that kind of a thing. Yeah.
So there's a couple quick things that I want to hit before we get to Joe's favorite films. Top 10.
Can't fucking wait.
Very, very excited to hear this. The two things that I wanted to hit. The first was the Ted Danson fiasco. I think it's interesting that they even decide to go there in this documentary. Yes. It might be the most sort of the boldest choice they make in this documentary is to kind of try to unpack that situation. They don't really get to the bottom of it. And as was the case back in the day, Whoopi seems to be the one who's more outspoken about what her goals were for that fiasco, and that Bruce was just kind of taken along for the ride, thinking that it would be funny, and it just didn't play. Yeah. Honestly, seeing the photos again of Ted Danson,
that whole thing kind of sucks.
It was just not good. It was crazy. Yeah. But I appreciated that they talked about it, and showed, you know, not everything connects, I think was ultimately what they were trying to get at.
Sure. Cautionary tale.
And the other thing was Robin Williams, who I think we spent probably anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes in a room with him and Bruce Valanche, and I was fucking exhausted. The idea of what it must be like to sit in a room with the two of them, I mean, I love Robin Williams. We all rest in peace. Obviously loved the man, loved most of his work. The thing I least liked about Robin Williams, I mean, not all of his movies, not everything he did, but what I liked least about him was when he went on talk shows, because he just like, it was like somebody like uncorked him and he just like fucking talks at like a mile a minute, a bunch of shit that half of it doesn't work. He's just on to another joke. And you're just like, oh my God, this is exhausting.
That's Here's what I'll like. Say to that, though, and possibly an exception, or possibly I just appreciate it maybe more. The final Johnny Carson episode was a clip show. The second last Johnny Carson episode with guests was Robin Williams and Bette Midler. So perfect for this movie. Robin Williams was exactly what you say. It was all like, everything was topical, right? Dan Quayle jokes, Murphy Brown jokes, blah, 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 everything that was in the news back then.
God, what a wild man.
And then Bette Midler was, of course, bawdy for a while and then sentimental. Like, the whole thing, I think, is a spectacular hour of television. One of the best television episodes ever. And Carson's appreciation of Robin Williams makes me see him sort of, you know, through those eyes a little bit. It's exhausting. You're right. It is a mile a minute. It is, where is his brain going? But it's also, where is his brain going? You know what I mean? There's a little bit of a fascination of just like, how are you like coming up with this? Cause it really does feel like it's coming up off of the top of his head. And it's something to see, I will say. And that is also on YouTube, that if your algorithm, if it's heard me talk now, it'll maybe,
it's just, so, I've spoken about,
you've spoken
Robin before on the show, that it never quite clicked with me.
Sure.
And
I mean, we also had to do bad
Robin movies, and there are Robin movies I really love.
A great era.
Of course, like everybody, there are a half dozen or more that I love.
Yeah.
But the idea of being in a room with him scares the shit out of me.
Sure.
Yeah. And my sense is that he's a very bad improv partner. And I think life is improv. I think that maybe I am too, but being in a room with someone who is so, this is mean, but ungenerous in his, you know, ability to like collaborate in the moment with someone.
I hear that.
Is like, that's scary for me. And I feel like he's the only one where I felt like Bruce Vilanch was like, I don't even know how to work. Like, I really felt like he was like, I don't even know what to do with him. Yeah. You know, like with
you do get that impression.
It was with Robin. You have to do this. You have to do that. And if he was able to do anything with Robin, that is like kind of a miracle in and of itself. Yeah. Because I don't believe, like when you say, Joe, it sounds like it's coming off the top of his head. I think it is. Right. Like, yeah. I think he might come in with some, you know, he might come in with some temples. I got to hit this. I got to hit that. I got to hit this. But for the most part, I think he is just like, you know, fucking firing.
It's crazy to think that the man did cocaine. Because it feels like, right? Like when you see him
or
in this,
stopped,
right? Or yeah, that,
well,
that's kind
of one
of
the two.
Like,
right?
What it's he either, was like on cocaine back in the day, like when he did, you know, his stand up routines that are all available that you can see. Like, he is just, it's wild. Madness.
Yeah.
But let's rate this real quick. And then let's do your top 10, Joe. I gave this a 60. I mean, I didn't fucking hate this movie. I wouldn't say like, don't ever watch this thing. And I do think that as a time capsule, it is an interesting little time capsule of sort of an already dead genre of comedy. And maybe this is like its kind of last gasp, if you will. And I think also something we forgot to mention that I do think is worthwhile. We don't see a lot of it. Wish we got more of it, but more behind the scenes of the Oscars, like actually getting to see some of the mechanics of what actually happens in terms of getting that show on its feet is a fascinating thing. And I
always hope fun.
I hope that someday someone like does a legit documentary. About one of them, because like fucking, first of all, I don't know how much longer we're going to have the Oscars on telecast. There's that. Right. But then on top of everything, I just kind of feel like it would just be really cool to just be a fly on the wall.
They should do it this year. You're totally right.
I think they should.
Yes, they should.
So that's where I'm at. What about you, Kenny? What's your rating on this?
Before this, I gave it a 62 because I think that it was a good time at the movies. And I'm going to stay there. I think, like, look.
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
If you're under 80 minutes, you've already, you know, you're already above 50 for me. And I didn't hate it.
Like a guy who's been doing a podcast for 5 years.
It's easy. I know. Look at these bags under my eyes. Like, doing a podcast and raising 4 children. I'm just a moron. What was I saying? Yeah, Bruce.
It's under 80 minutes, so you love it.
Yeah, Bruce, I'm sticking at 62. What do you got, Joe?
Yeah, what are you?
I'm right in the same neighborhood. I was going to say 65. Yeah. You know, not great, not terrible. An interesting subject, I thought, and you know, I didn't hate it. I didn't hate myself watching it.
So. No, I didn't either. So I didn't hate you watching it, Joe.
Thank
more
you.
More importantly, Joe.
Yes.
Let's hear your top 10 movies of 1999.
All right.
Starting from
so.
Oh wait, Joe. As you go, yeah. Give yes. us time to judge it.
Certainly. Yeah. So with the caveat that I pulled up my little Word document, I did not tinker with this before we recorded this. I did not make my revisions or whatever. So this is reflective of the last time I edited this, which was, I am not sure. Okay. So number 10, I know is a movie you guys don't love as much as I do, but number 10 for me is Doug Liman's Go.
I don't know where I stand.
Deep personal favorite.
I don't even
I
know
love
where
the first chapter.
I don't even know where I stand on it anymore.
Yeah. I don't either. That was
as you
third
know,
movie.
One of
the
my
third
favorite
movie we did
very early
on my beginning of the year top 10. One of my favorite movies. I thought going into this did not like my rewatch at all, but I still feel like I have a lot of love for it.
I feel similarly, Kenny. I love the Sarah Pauli section. That goes without saying. Don't hate the second chunk. Really don't like the gay panic third act.
I kind of love the end.
Well, you know, it's one of my Katie favorite Holmes final Elizabeth. Like yeah, she finds the keys. One of my favorite final lines in a movie, the so what are we doing for New Year's Nathan Bexton line in the movie.
Where'd he go?
That guy was genuinely good. No idea. Yeah. Like have not seen him in anything since. Yeah.
All right, number 9.
Number 9, Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia.
Low. Okay.
I know. Yeah. Listen, it's of no dislike to the movie. I just like 8 other movies better.
It's a great year. You know, what can we say? But
we should probably figure out what the fuck we're doing about that movie. I haven't even figured out how we're going to do that episode. Anyway, moving on.
I'll just have to order the frogs.
If you thought that was low, you may also think this is low. My number 8 is The Matrix.
No.
Okay.
I think that's okay. Keep going.
I mean, because I'm sure. Trying to think. I keep thinking about like our final lists at the end of all of this. And The Matrix is fucking great. It's obviously a masterpiece. I don't know that it'll break my top 5, but we'll see.
Well, I think the way I almost feel about The Matrix at this point is like I want to preface this by saying I love this movie emotionally, but I almost respect it more than I love it now. Like I almost am at the point where like I am obligated to put it super high because I think it is such an incredible achievement.
It's an institution.
And deservedly so. You know, not like some of these that are not like it's worthy of its high placement, but I don't like it's in the running for my number 1 of the year. So who knows? All right.
Yeah. My number 7 is Michael Mann's The Insider.
Nice.
I'm not really a Michael Mann guy. There are Michael Mann people out there. I respect them. I am not one of them. This is by far my favorite Michael Mann.
Interesting.
Movie. It's so, so good. It's insane that Christopher Plummer, speaking of Christopher Plummer, that was not in this episode. That was the last episode we were talking about that. Not nominated. For playing Mike Wallace, which is insane. He's so, so, so good in that.
Very weird.
Great movie. And I remember when we did our episode, which was a few years ago now, but still, that was definitely a great rewatch. That was one of those that I was like, I knew this movie was great. I'm not sure I knew how.
Totally agree with you.
Yeah.
What's your 6?
My 6, Catch Me on a Different Day, and this could be like as high as number 2. My number 6 is Election. Just a tremendous comedy from the best year for comedy that we've had. I think we've decided in this episode. I think we've made that determination.
This has gone from the worst to the best. Yeah,
I can't wait. So, what number was that? Number 6.
That was 6. Right,
so you have 5 more.
Yeah.
I have a feeling I know what your number 1 is, Joe, but I could be wrong. I think
you probably do.
I think I do.
All right, go ahead. I'm interested to hear the top 5.
All right, my number 5 is The Blair Witch Project, which...
Oh, interesting.
Great answer.
I have not budged since 1999 that's one of my 5 best movies of the year. It's...
Great movie.
I mean, we all know it's The Blair Witch Project. You know, that's another sort of like institution in a different way, kind of.
Yes.
You're not going to tell anybody anything they don't know about the Blair Witch Project, but I think it's tremendous. Yep. It is spooky season, so I'm going to have to do my annual rewatch of that movie because it is
a movie.
So, so good. My number four, and I have no idea where you guys are, because I don't know. Maybe I. Anyway, my number four is Fight Club.
We love it.
We love it. Yeah. We talked a little bit about this recently. I think it might have been on
with War Room as well.
Yeah, with Jessica.
Yeah.
It's a movie that we all kind of are bummed about it being co-opted by the shittiest people in this country. And how it's kind of got a stink on it now when it's a fucking great movie. Yeah.
It's tremendous.
Yeah. It's unfortunate that in order to tell someone you like it, you also have to make it clear that you don't suck.
Yeah, right.
I hate that thing. So I love it, but I don't suck. So
it's a lot smarter than a lot of people who love it are. So
I was not prepared to love it as much as I did. I thought I would not love it. It's like, you know, I don't know what your number three is. I don't want to give anything away. So keep going.
Yeah. My number three is The Sixth Sense.
Yeah, I mean, movie. Speaking of spooky season, I remember we did it for Halloween, whatever year we decided to do it for Halloween, Kenny and I.
We did early.
And it was just the two of us. And that was another big rewatch for me where I was like, I don't know that I love this film as much as everyone else does. And then I watched it and I was like, no, this is.
But I think I was a little unnecessarily harsh on it. Like, I love the movie. Love this film. And one of the. You know what? What did we say? I think the Mount Rushmore of this year.
Yeah.
You know, not necessarily the best movies of this year, not my top four, but like those like institution movies: Matrix, Blair Witch, Sixth Sense, and I mean, what would you say the fourth is? I have a bunch of contenders for the fourth.
I mean, yeah, 99. You got so many.
It's hard. I mean, what did you say? Fight Club. Sorry,
it's definitely Fight Club, Matrix, and Blair Witch,
and Sixth Sense.
Oh, okay. No, not Fight Club. It's Matrix, Blair Witch, Sixth Sense, and I don't know
I think you could probably put up there.
There's an argument for that. There's an argument for, I mean, I would say being
John Malkovich is the one I would say. Being John Malkovich is the one I would say is the one that's so 99 and means so much to so many people. Like these movies that.
Funny that you should mention it.
That be your number two?
It's my number two is being John Malkovich. Yeah.
So your number one. Your number one is. I think I know what it is.
I think I know.
It's Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yeah.
It's the best movie of that year. It's so good.
It's
tremendous.
I can't wait to see where it winds up on your list, Phil, because you speak about it like it's you just cheered. You speak about it like it's your number one, and I don't think it's necessarily.
It's not my number one. I know it's not my number one, but I think that when we lay them all out at the end of this I really do think that film is going to be higher. Than it was when
it was pretty high for you in the beginning.
It was pretty. I don't think it was in my top five.
No, I think it was like seven or eight. I think it was pretty high.
It is. It's a movie that I adore. I've watched it. I don't really know even how to articulate how much I love all the different pastiche of things that it's playing in. It's Minghella at his best. I love a lot of his movies, but that movie I think is just.
And not that this movie needs to be reclaimed because it never really fell out of favor, but I do feel like it does need a bit of a kick in the ass to move it up everybody's mental, you know, kind of rankings of 99 movies, of Matt Damon movies, of Hitchcock adjacent movies, of all these movies that I think people respect it, but kind of forgotten it.
It's currently in the realm of like, oh, you know what's underrated is the Talented Mr. Ripley, and it needs to be boosted up into like the unadorned, like unqualified.
It needs some podcast host to put it at number one for its list of the year. Who's watched every single movie of the year, and for people to be like, do you know what Phil Lisko put for his number one after watching every movie of the year? Talented Mr. Ripley, but I guess it. You know, because when I'm sitting here with like Malkovich, people are like, oh, whatever, Neimert sucks. But
I will say this, though. I do think what it also needs, truthfully, is kind of like a fucking bells and whistles crazy like release on 4K or a Criterion or a something.
That could be a nice little boost.
because it just feels as though.
But I feel like those people already know. I don't know how you do it at this point.
I don't know. I don't know. But it's absolutely the right choice, Joe. I mean, I really do think like, yeah, it does feel like. I'll say this though, Kenny, in the conversations and the various articles that have existed of like talking about 1999, and there are no shortage of them, it does feel like that might be at the top of the list of movies that people don't think gets enough love from 1999. Yeah. Like it does feel to me like
I agree with that.
It's not everyone always goes like Being John Malkovich number one or something along those lines, right. But that's always the one that's like, you know, guys, Talk to Mr. Ripley, kind of a stone cold masterpiece. Why aren't we talking about it more?
Here's what I would say.
Yeah.
When we started this podcast, the film at the top of that list was Eyes Wide Shut.
Correct.
Now Eyes Wide Shut is no longer at the top of that list. Now Eyes Wide Shut is firmly in like the, you know, people's understanding of, you know, the year, the moment, Cruise, Kubrick, everything. Like Eyes Wide Shut has solidified itself.
Correct.
Talented Richard Lee now, I think, maybe honestly with Blair Witch, might be now at the top of that list of people being like, you know, the people who love it needing to be like, you got to rewatch this. You got to rewatch this. You have to understand this wasn't just a thing at the moment. You have to understand this isn't just this. This isn't just that. This is actually like what's the word I'm looking for? Whatever. This is Hall of Fame material.
Here. I'll say, you know what I'll say too, to kind of piggyback on that, to kind of come back to what we're talking about the Oscars. This is the movie by Ripley. I mean, is the how was this not a massive Oscar contender in 1999 movie? Like it's definitely that. When you look at the 1999 Academy Awards, as slanted as they were towards American Beauty because it was such a, you know, a phenomenon.
Yeah,
you know, no one talks about fucking Siderhurst Rules, which has a Best Supporting Actor and Adapted Screenplay winner in 1999. It's a movie that straight up doesn't fucking exist. We talked about it on the Ripley episode. I think we talked about it on the Siderhurst Rules episode about how, you know, it was a
co-pro. I literally don't know the fucking answer to this question, Phil.
It was a co-pro.
I'm usually good at this.
I think that Weinstein went all in on Siderhurst Rules rather than Ripley because Paramount had the domestic on Ripley, and I guess, you know, whatever, ego, blah, 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 who knows what. But point is, like, Ripley should have gotten so many nominations. It's crazy that
it was the perfect storm of fatigue with Ripley, honestly. It was Minghella was suffering from English patient fatigue. Gwyneth Paltrow fatigue had set in the second she took the stage to win her Oscar. Yeah. Matt Damon fatigue was even happening a little bit in terms of like the prestige thing. That's why the only person who gets anything is Jude Law, because he was fresh and new and exciting. And
cool. And this was also one of the great and Jude Laws, because this was Academy Award winner Minghella, Academy Award winner Matt Damon, Academy Award winner Gwyneth Paltrow, I believe Academy Award winner Kate Blanchett at this point.
She had nominated.
Oh, because she didn't win, right? Yeah. So she Academy Award nominee Kate Blanchett and Jude Law.
And Jude Law.
Yeah.
Yep. But that could have, honestly, it wouldn't have been true, but you could have said and introducing Jude Law and gotten away.
You could have. Well,
Who hadn't seen Gattaca would have been
in a sense, even if you had seen Gattaca, you kind of worked. And you won't believe how good looking a person could be on screen. Yeah, Jude Law. Exactly.
He's just a sun-kissed Jude Law for a good 90 minutes.
Tremendous.
The most handsome anyone has ever looked in a movie. It's just that simple.
It is that simple. Joe, a pleasure as always.
Thank you, guys.
We're so thankful to have you come on one last time.
I can't believe we're done.
To talk
with your top 10.
That's a series wrap on.
Clap them out.
99 with Joe.
Thank you, Joe.
A blast as always. You know, we both love your podcast.
Listen, you know, every time you've had me on here, it's been a blast. So
we always love having you on, Joe.
Thank you.
So, all right. You know.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
I feel like Abby Cornish and Bimal Shah right now.
All right, bye guys.
All right, later.
Podcast like it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.